Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Oh, I'm dandy.
I am just so happy to be talking about movies. Wait, not movies? Maybe not movies with friends. Maybe we're going to talk about books today. We're joining book talk. Is that what I understand?
I'm so excited.
Spoilers. First up in controversies and non-controversies, we will do some film talk here because we're talking AI again. We're gonna start talking about AI witch hunts. The witch hunts have begun. Following the release of the trailer for the forthcoming film Ochi from Studio A24 and filmmaker Isaiah Saxon, people on the internet were angry. Can you believe it? People on the internet were mad. What were they mad about this time? Specifically, they were angry about the look of the film, which stars Finn Wolfhard and Emily Watson and Willem Dafoe, among others, because it looked like some of the sequences had been done with AI. You know, and you know it when you see it, right? It's kind of that view from nowhere with a slightly off parallax effect, right? The things aren't moving quite right in the background and the foreground. The textures aren't quite right. Had to be AI, right? We all know AI when we see it. Wrong. Not AI. The director was like, hey, this is just what my movies look like, right? And if you look at some clips from his previous efforts, well, yeah, you can see what he means. All right, here's his actual response. And it's pretty measured, considering that accusations of AI use are near death penalty stuff at this point in the AI wars. He simply said, quote, "This was handmade over 6 years on a $10 million budget with puppets, animatronics, matte paintings, shot on location in the Carpathian Mountains. There is no AI in this film," end quote. And you can understand why folks are on edge, right? Given that the plagiarism machines that are AI as they currently exist and that are being tested by studios small and large to see what they can get away with are kind of running rampant, right? Blumhouse recently announced it was teaming up with Meta and their AI program to give filmmakers some AI tools to see what they could generate, right? Talent like Casey Affleck and Anish Shaganti were amongst those picked. And Shaganti, I'm probably butchering his last name here, I apologize. He's an interesting choice because he's made some movies I really like, Searching and Missing, both of which can be described as something like screen movies, right? They're movies that tell their stories entirely through what we see on other screens. So people looking at phone screens or TV screens or laptop screens, security camera screens, etc. We see what the screens see, and that's what tells the story. That's how we understand the plot of the film, right? So AI then could just be considered another tool like phone screens or like, YouTube clips, et cetera, that can be used as a tool to tell these stories, right? So the short video he made for Meta can only be described as an advertisement for the service, right? It is like a straight up 2.5 minute ad. I'll include the video in the email that goes out with this podcast, but in it, he takes old homemade video clips from films he made as a teenager that he shot on, you know, the little home VHS camera. He takes these old homemade video clips and he runs them through Meta's program. He uses it to add cityscape backgrounds, to transform a kitchen into a bank vault, to turn a chintzy Halloween costume into a walking, talking alien, right? And in a voiceover, he says, quote, "The thing I like about this tool is that little Anish would still have had to make the movie." Emphasis on the word make there. And that's true. He would still have to, you know, get his people to do the acting and pick out the shots and blah, blah, blah. But watching both the before and the after, what I was struck by was the way Meta took what was an endearing, rough, homemade, handmade thing and just gave it this glossy sheen of sameness, like sticking on emoji stickers onto something, right? You can imagine the effect being applied to everything in the exact same way, stripping out that rough-hewn quality that gives home movies so much heart, that makes them so fun to look back on, and rendering them all of the same glossy, generic slop. I think back to the movie The Fablemans, right? And Steven Spielberg, which is essentially Steven Spielberg telling the story of Steven Spielberg and him making home movies in his backyard and with his neighborhood friends and trying to solve the problem of filmmaking, you know, trying to figure out where cameras go and how cameras should move and what blood should look like, right? If you could just shoot anything and say, well, we'll fix it in post. Actually, you know what? that would prep you better to be a filmmaker today than just about anything else, because this is what the studio slop factories have set up to do, right? You shoot it and you're like, ah, we'll fix it in post. We'll fix it in post. I'm joking a little bit, but it really does feel like the death of genuine creativity in exchange for something that gets nominally closer to whatever vision somebody has in their head, but looks the same. It just looks like an undifferentiated mass. Peter, if this is the best case argument for AI, and Meta certainly seems to think it is, given that they're hosting it on their YouTube page, it's kind of disappointing, right?
I didn't find it disappointing at all. I actually just really strongly disagree with you on this. I first of all didn't think that it looked bad in the way that you're describing. I didn't find that the sort of it looked less charming or, you know, yes, it looks a little less obviously handmade, because when you see the transformation in front of you of something that is just I don't know, 90s or mid-aughts, you know, video camera footage into something that has been digitally remade by AI, yes, you can see, oh, that's fake, that's whatever. I certainly don't think it looks worse than a lot of the kind of mediocre green screen or LED wall stuff that we are seeing that's much more expensive. And so if nothing else, it provides the same quality for a much, like, just much faster and much lower cost. But the other thing is, one thing this video tries to highlight, but I think doesn't fully communicate, is that AI may have a kind of house style for some of the images that it's generating right now. There may be a kind of consistent look to it in some cases, but that's not going to last very long. AI is going to look, you're going to be able to produce wildly different aesthetics, from very rough to very polished to very cartoony and everything in between. This idea that AI is always just going to look like this sort of one thing that we are used to, I think is really, really wrong. And I think it's wrong. Like, one of the ways you can sort of tell is that it's wrong is by the freak out over this filmmaker's over this trailer, is that people think they can identify it. And we are quickly entering a world in which you are not going to be able to tell the difference in many cases. Some cases, for sure. But in many cases, you are not going to be able to tell which thing was generated via AI and which thing was not. And this is going to end up being a tool for creativity on the cheap. And as I've always said, much of what gets made with it will be crap. But that's always true. And the more stuff you make, the more crap there is. But the fact that a lot of it will be crap does not change, doesn't invalidate the this thing, you know, AI is AI's usefulness as a tool for inexpensive, accessible filmmaking. And I think that to me is the thing that came out from watching that video. Not this looks bland or samey, but, oh, you can use this to make it possible for the next 10-year-old filmmaker to make something that he or she couldn't have made 20 years ago or even 5 years ago. And that technology is only going to get better and better, more interesting, more varied, more realistic in some cases, more cartoony in others. But it's not just going to end up looking like, oh, well, everything feels like it came out of the you call it slop. I think some of it, I get that, but like, even that, I think is, honestly, I love you, Sonny, but like, I think that's a little bit of a lazy criticism. It has a distinctive aesthetic currently, but that aesthetic is going to change, and it's not just going to change, it's going to become hugely varied in the same way that, like, a lot of green screen and digital work that is handcrafted, so-called, in Hollywood right now, a lot of it looks terrible and a lot of it looks really samey. But that doesn't mean it has to look terrible or that it has to look samey. And these digital tools are going to be as good as the people using them, at least for the, you know, near term.
Peter, can I ask a technical question, though, that I think also gets at the heart of your argument, which is, you know, what do we make of the fact that, you know, these tools which have been trained on, you know, big sets of human generated images, or human generated is the wrong word, human created images, human written words, etc., are eventually going to start training on material that they've produced themselves, right? I mean, my understanding is that there's a fairly significant concern even among people who are fairly boostery about AI that you know, these systems may end up sort of collapsing in on themselves, not in the sense that they get more inaccurate or less functional, but that their horizons, you know, won't sort of broaden forever. Is that something you have concerns about?
I think that's a possibility. Well, like, a big thing with AI is that we don't know where the peak or is. There are people who are sort of, but a lot of people are making a mistake right now of saying, well, this is what AI looks like. And,
assuming that's,
and I'm not saying you are, but a lot of the criticism is, this is what AI looks like. It looks bad. And therefore, AI will always look bad. I don't think that's true.
Right.
But the thing we don't know is, there's definitely folks out there who are working on this stuff in a closely at some of the high performing AI shops who are like, maybe we will reach the peak of AI's abilities in 6 months. But also there are folks who are like, maybe we'll reach it in 100 years. Like, who knows how much headroom there is. And so I think so, I, you know, and part of the question is when it starts inevitably. Yes, if we have progress here, if it sort of keeps moving, inevitably AIs will end up training or learn. Let's call it just learning. Based on stuff that is either entirely or partially created by other AIs. And there's two possibilities there. One is that makes them much smarter, much faster, because you're getting multiple intelligences basically bouncing off of each other. The other is that you have a degradation of the quality in a sort of VHS copying VHS type of, and we don't know how that's going to go. And possibly it's going to go both directions at the same time. And you will get some stuff that's much smarter and some stuff that's much dumber.
Alyssa, can I just clarify? Because I don't think that is exactly the concern, right? The concern is not so much the VHS dupe problem where like something gets fuzzier and fuzzier, right? It's that everything, again, if you are training an AI to create images based on other AI sets, it's going to start kind of becoming recursive in a way. It's going to copy itself over and over again and in ways that may be slightly different, but like, again, I think there are two separate issues here as well. One is the creativity issue. The other is the kind of copyright and mining the whole of, you know, human work without consent, which is a separate secondary issue.
But could I try and bring those two concerns together a little bit? Because I do think they're actually sort of created. And, you know, Peter, you kind of skipped over the difference between training and learning. But I do think those things are quite different, right? And I mean, there is, I think, a broad consensus that we probably haven't reached artificial general intelligence yet, which is sort of a kind of AI distinct from large language models, which really can think independently, right? I mean, we have these AI sets, these large language models, these image generators that can produce images on demand, images or words on demand, sort of based on a corpus of what they have already been trained on and sort of constrained by rules that it has either been fed or discerned by the material that it's been trained on. My question then, I mean, I both share Sunny's concern about the sort of homogenization process of AI potentially sort of becoming more samey. But that also brings me back to sort of a question with the ad, right? The tagline is kind of like, you know, something like maybe Little Anish would have dreamed bigger if he had these tools at hand. And my question is, would he? Because there's sort of a child development question at play here, right? It's like, do kids learn more? Do they become more creative when more of the blanks are sort of filled in for them, right? I mean, there's sort of a constant back and forth between toy developers who want to sell kids things that do something extremely specific because then you need more toys to do other things, versus child development experts who are like, here's a block of wood. It can be a car. It can be a race. It can be a, you know, shoeshine box. It can be a spaceship, right? And so I think there is a really genuinely really interesting question about creativity that comes into play when you have something that has the potential to fill in so many blanks for you, right? I mean, you know, saying make it Manhattan. Does AI get to decide that Manhattan is just the skyline? Does Manhattan mean 8 million things to the 8 million different people who live there? And would it be more interesting if we had, you know, 8 million different answers to the question of what it means to make something Manhattan, right? Like, what does it mean if all of our aliens look the same, or right, all of our futuristic cities, or all of our apocalypses?
I want to emphasize one thing Alyssa's saying here, and bring it back to something I had mentioned, which is when I say I watched this video of him, you know, upgrading his childhood videos, and there's something really, like, depressingly kind of soul-destroying about it. Because, again, it's not that the skyline of New York looks like the same or anything, you know, whatever. It's when he says, make it an alien. And it's this weirdly generic version of an alien that, again, looks like an emoji sticker that you just kind of slap on the thing. And if you give kids, if you tell kids, like, all right, make it Lilo, like from Lilo and Stitch, right? The thing can do that, but it, like, also just...
It's not going to invent Stitch, right? Like,
right. It narrows their vision to what already exists. It is, you're training kids to be like, copy the thing I've seen before and make it look like that. And, like, that works for some folks. It works fine for J.J. Abrams, right? J.J. Abrams can get away with that. But I don't know that that's the best thing for helping kids become creative. Yeah.
I very much think that it, especially when you're starting off as an artist, as some sort of creative person, you're copying things that you've seen pretty much exclusively already, and then you're trying to come up with a novel synthesis, maybe add one. Eventually, if you are very successful, you can add some totally original elements. But even a lot of the best artists are basically just synthesizers. The other thing, though, that I would say is that thinking about, so I don't talk about this very much, but, like, I wanted to be a filmmaker when I was a kid. I did not become a filmmaker. I did a little bit of video work when I was in my 20s for some nonprofit organizations. But I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I spent a lot of time with my friends making little home movies, and they were embarrassing and poor quality. But part of the reason they were embarrassing and poor quality is because I had weak tools, because at first all we had was a video camera. Then eventually we got this was a video camera that actually recorded directly into video. This was pre-digital video days. And so eventually we got two VCRs that we could use to very clumsily do a tiny bit of editing. But even there, the editing process was so difficult and so time consuming. You just couldn't do very much of that. And the moment when I was able to switch over to digital video and move into a space where I could actually do something like real editing, because I had access to Adobe Premiere, was just an absolutely huge deal, because I had all these ideas that I couldn't execute. There was just simply no way for me to execute them using the prior tools. And so digital tools made it possible for me to execute ideas that I'd had in my head that didn't exist. And partly it wasn't just editing. It was also that because it was all digital, I could do early green screen stuff. I could add in motion graphics. I could add in captions and all these other things that made stuff much more interesting and much better. And yes, of course, I was very young when I was doing all of this. And so if you went back, you would look back and say, Peter, this is very amateurish. I'm not bragging that I was a great filmmaker or anything like that. At the same time, there's a huge difference in my work, in the work that I was able to do, and in the ability to bring my what was in my head onto a screen based on the access to the tools that I had. And what this does is it gives people a tool that they didn't have before. And that is going to change what filmmakers can do, especially filmmakers who otherwise might have been highly constrained by access, by budgets, by the fact that they just didn't have this stuff to make movies, because movies is a very expensive enterprise, very time consuming, very equipment intensive. And this just makes a lot of that more possible for more people.
Yeah, I guess I just see, in a way, I feel like this conversation that the three of us have been having,
yeah,
really for sort of 2 years at this point, kind of, right? 2 years, maybe, is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
You know, feels like it keeps getting stuck, in part because I think Sunny and I are having a slightly different conversation than the one that you are, right? And I mean, I think that, you know, Peter, you see this primarily as a tool. And I think
Sunny, I wish I'd had access to this when I was 17 years old.
100%. And I get that, and I'm even somewhat persuaded by it. But what I think Sunny and I are talking about and are worrying about is sort of, you know, we understand that this can be a tool, that it may end up being really useful for some people and even exciting. What we're worried about is what it does to, not to what you can translate from your imagination to the screen, but what it does to the imagination, right? Like we're, I think we're both wondering if it has a kind of, if the ability to do all of this so easily, and if the response to the prompt is so homogenizing, if that ends up, you know,
yeah,
if that ends up sort of narrowing the field of what we imagine instead of what we produce, right? Like, I think you're having a technical conversation and we're having almost like a child development.
Let me respond to that. We're running over time, but I'll just be very quick. Is one thing about AI, and one, just to go back to this, it doesn't always have to look the same thing, is that AI, anytime you prompt AI, you can keep prompting it. You can say, I want it to be different. I want it to be, and if you are good at prompting these things. In fact, I mean, look, I think the AI prompt engineer job thing that is happening right now is probably not going to last. At the same time, there are people who are better at it, and repeat attempts give you different results. And in fact, I was just gifted by my lovely wife over the weekend for my birthday, little tile coasters featuring a bull mastiff carrying a martini. And this was made via AI, and she had to prompt the AI a whole lot of different times in order to get this particular funny look that she wanted. And it was because the first thing that came out wasn't the right thing. And the second thing that came out wasn't the right thing. And this is like this idea that, oh, people are just going to accept the first. Yeah, some people will, but some people will have, as we know, a very intense and specific vision. The other thing, just to add to this, is that when digital tools became more common for younger filmmakers, there was a complaint amongst older filmmakers that if you're not, say, if you're not rewinding the tape each time and doing the physical process, you will be less creative because you'll think about it less. There were complaints about the crappy look of digital video, because in fact, early digital video did look very samey and flat and crappy. And
I
feel like a lot of these complaints have borne out, frankly. But also, I will be the bad guy here and play gatekeeper, and say that I think it's actually good that things should take longer and be harder. You should not have access to all of the tools that make your job easier, that make it easier to bring whatever your quote unquote vision is to life. It's actually good. It's actually good to have limits and force people to work around them.
You're welcome to take the horse and buggy and to wash your clothes by hand.
It's good that you couldn't just sit there and be like, I want my guy to have a Tommy gun and I want him to shoot 1,000 rounds and spray the crowd with. I think that's actually really good. I think forcing younger filmmakers in particular to work around these problems helps spur creativity, helps them create better visual solutions to whatever problem they have than, you know, just say do this and then it shows up on a screen. Or even if they have to say do this 6 or 7 times, even I hate to be the old bad gatekeeper on this one, but I'm perfectly fine playing that role. It's good to make things take longer and be harder.
I think that there are benefits to spending a longer time learning the underpinnings of your art, learning the craft, the background, the history, how to do it in a manual way. I think that I'm a cocktail guy, and I think that everyone should, for example, make their own bitters and amaro at least once, though most of the time you shouldn't, because actually you're not going to get better results than the stuff you can buy from the store. But you learn what it's like and what it takes and how this stuff is made and how it's all produced. Of course, there are benefits to that sort of thing, but there are also benefits to being able to do things that are simply impossible or extremely difficult to do well without these tools.
Well, I still think we're having slightly different conversations, and I want to think about how to get us into the same one, because I still think we're talking past ourselves in a way that makes it harder to move this forward.
Well, I don't know that there is any moving it forward. I think it is just we are at loggerheads. That's fine. That's a thing that happens sometimes. All right. Speaking of which, do we think it's a controversy or an controversy that we're arguing about AI yet again on this dumb show? Peter.
This show isn't dumb. It's controversial that you think that it is a controversy that this is still happening. I think it's crazy that people are going after filmmakers for using AI. But also, you know what? Go ahead and do that, because this stuff is coming. It's coming for you. And you, Sonny, you could say, well, you could stop it. I'm going to tell you can't. Because if you could stop it, Sonny, someone would. And that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen because you can't stop it.
Alyssa.
It's controversial to bully filmmakers, but also, like, imagination is weird and sui generis, and we should hang on to some of what makes us human.
It's a non-troversy that we keep talking about this, and it will be a non-troversy when people start bombing the AI centers, because Peter says it can't be stopped. I got some news for you, buddy. We got army legions of pseudo terrorists out there.
The Ministry for the Future.
Nobody bomb an AI center, but I do think that I am opposed to bombing the AI centers. No, but I think it's you say that nobody can stop this, and I'm curious to know if that's true. We'll see what happens here in the next few years. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday, where we're going to be talking about some of our favorite scary books in honor of Halloween. Speaking of books, on to the main event. So normally this is where we would review a movie, right? The podcast is called Across the Movie Aisle, after all. But this week, it was kind of a weird week at the box office, and we thought we'd do something slightly different because it's a little bit dead out in movie land right now. I think everybody got out of the way of Joker 2. Whoops. We wanted to mix things up a little bit. So we are reviewing Polo Stan, which is the new book from Neal Stephenson. I'm very excited to talk about this because I think all of us on this show are fans of Neal Stephenson. And when you think about Stephenson, he kind of has two modes of writing, right? The first is what we might think of as like kind of sci-fi futurism. That encompasses books like Snow Crash, which is where the word metaverse comes from, interestingly. The Diamond Age, Seven Eves, a bunch of other books that we could kind of fit in description. And then there are the historical epics, right? Like his Baroque Cycle, which I have the first two books of on my shelf and have yet to start reading. I find them very intimidating. They're so big. And then Cryptonomicon, which would also, I think, fall under the historical epic name. But those books also have elements of science fiction in them. I think Stephenson himself has described them as science fiction books of a sort because they're concerned with new technologies and how they influence society. Polo Stan falls squarely into the category of historical epic, though it's briefer in length than some of the other books mentioned here. It's just 300 pages long. It's the first entry in his forthcoming Bomblight cycle. And it does feel very much like the first act of a story. When you get to the end of it, you'll be like, okay, what's next? We open in 1933 as a young woman named Dawn gets ready to set sail for the Soviet Union, where she will be known as Aurora. Aurora being Dawn, whatever. Aurora. She was named after a Soviet warship by her communist father. The book hops kind of back and forth between Aurora's activities in the present in Stalin-era Soviet Union, and then her earlier life, where she was hopping back and forth between America and Lenin's Soviet Union. In the USSR, we see a successful communist revolution and all that entails. The joy of the working class coming together to do great things. The secret police and the death squads and the gulags and the psychiatric wards for those who do not toe the party line and as a result get horribly tortured. In the US, we see a socialist revolution fail. Revolutionaries hiding as bonus army protesters scattered by the US military. In the midst of all of this, a scientific revolution is taking place, the birth of the atomic age. Now, if you've seen Oppenheimer, this basically takes place a decade earlier. X-ray machines were kind of treated like toys, sometimes with devastating consequences, as we see in this book. The structure for the book chosen by Stephenson makes it a little bit episodic, right? We hop back and forth between Aurora's time in the Soviet Union and her time in America. In the Soviet Union, where she has traveled to work at an enormous steel mill for which the Soviets may have something a little bit darker planned. She is being questioned as a spy, and that questioning takes an altogether very dark turn, as one might expect, of an apparatus run by noted psychopath Leventry Beria. In America, meanwhile, she kind of goes coast to coast, right? We travel from the Bonus Army riots to the Chicago's World Fair in 1933, then to the plains of North Dakota, where her mother's family lives. The book is sprawling. This is a kind of a sprawling, it's an episodic epic, if you will. We kind of go from coast to coast, country to country, continent to continent. But it zips along as a result. Once you get into the rhythms of the structure of the book, it's hard to put down. It's got everything. It's got Berea. It's got Ukrainian famine. It's got George S. Patton. It's got psychiatric torture. It's got extended sequences about polo. Polo. Who would have thought? A murder plot. A band of outlaw bank robbers. Again, this book has just about everything. And I look, here's the thing. I have a weird relationship to Stevenson in terms of how I read him. I sometimes have a lot of trouble getting into the rhythms of his books. I sometimes joke he's the novelist I most enjoy reading whose writing I actually have the most trouble with. Seven Eves, Riamde, Anathem. These are all books I started and then put down and then had to restart again a few weeks or months later just because I was like, all right, what am I reading here? What is happening? What is going on? But then once you get into it, you go with it. He's not difficult to understand. He's a great writer. He makes difficult ideas come across simply. He just throws you into the deep end and you got to swim your way to shore. Alyssa, what did you make of Polo, Stan? It sounded like you liked it.
Oh man, I enjoyed this so much. And part of it, you know, I just enjoy Stevenson as a prose stylist tremendously. And, you know, one thing I was thinking about when I read this book is that he's one of the great sort of list writers among contemporary novelists. And lists are really hard to do well, but his have just sort of incredible cadence. If you'll indulge me for a second, you know, when Dawn/Aurora, you know, visits the World's Fair, which in the book is referred to as the Century of Progress, you know, this is sort of her entry point to it, right? It's like one day, for example, she saw a dwarf buying a paper at a newsstand, and the next day, the pair of them on a streetcar, and then suddenly they were everywhere, as often as not, dressed in miniature lederhosen and dirndls. Indian chiefs, or at least Indians with imposing headgear, busloads of showgirls, yodelers, Civil War veterans and bathing beauties, flatbed trucks with alligators, ostriches, vintage locomotives, giant pumpkins, Frigidaires, rickshaws, x-ray machines, and potted Florida orange trees all went north on Drexel and did not come back. A man identified as C.C. Slim Williams trundled down the street behind his dog sled and his team of huskies, which he had driven all the way from his home in Copper Center, Alaska, the first 1,800 miles on snow, and the balance on a wheeled contraption interposed between skids and pavement. A quarterback from Dallas stood up Drexel with a 135-pound bale of cotton on his back. He had toted it 1,200 miles so that the world would not live in ignorance of the glories of Lone Star agriculture. And it keeps going, right? I mean, it is just this delightful set of juxtapositions, but also, you know, the words and the flood of words function to put you in the sort of flood of humanity convening on the Century of Progress, right? I mean, Stevenson is a writer whose prose is so in service to his ideas that it is just a total treat to kind of be swept along by him, even if it does, you know, sometimes take a while to get going. And I will be honest,
and
I have
maybe not go anywhere in particular except everywhere.
Exactly, right? And you know, I have to say, I mean, there's a point in the acknowledgments here where Stevenson says he'll have longer acknowledgments in the future as it becomes clearer where this project, because this book I think is conceived of the first of at least several in a series, is going. And I will confess that at the end of this book, I'm not totally sure where all of this is going. I mean, clearly some of it is going to involve the Ukrainian famine, and given the like bomb light subhead, it's going to involve the development of the Soviet atomic bomb. But it's clearly going to involve a bunch of completely separate jaunts to entirely different locations. And, you know, I think there are a lot of good writers who are good at writing sort of individual sentences or choosing individual words or sketching characters well. But Stevenson is, I think, remarkably good at choosing the structure of his sentences and the flow of his words to match, you know, literally in the process of reading and absorbing the information in your brain, creates the same effect that he wants, you know, sort of the characters to be feeling, you to be understanding. And he does a lot of that sort of rushing along with lists. He's also very good at sort of stopping for the short sharp juxtaposition, right? I mean, you know, when Dawn slash Aurora gets to the Century of Progress, she's with this group of German exile communists. And he has this aside that FDR legalized it being beer on the same day as Himmler had opened Dachau, right? And so he's spotted this irony in the end of Prohibition, the open in America, the opening of Dachau in Germany, you know, this freedom rushing into America, the world sort of slamming shut in Germany. And I feel like if you're listening to this podcast, it would be more effective for you to see how wildly I'm gesticulating while saying all of this, because Stevenson's writing produces that sense of sort of opening and closing and physical momentum. And again, not totally sure where all of this is going, but I am, I find this, I mean, and I also think if you are not someone who, you know, has been a Stevenson person before or is necessarily drawn to the very techie stuff, this might be a good place to start because the historical markers will be familiar. There are not a lot of, there aren't a ton of really important characters. It's actually like a fairly small number of characters who appear kind of episodically and then exit the stage. But I think it would be a good entry point into why those of us who like Stevenson find him so delightful.
I think that's I think that that is totally true. Like, I would not necessarily recommend like a Seven Eves or even a Diamond Age, maybe not even Snow Crash, though I do think Snow Crash has his best opening, his best like introduction to a world. That that whole opening 50 pages is just unputdownable. But this is a very easily digested book. It's again, it helps. I feel like people get intimidated. Lord knows. Again, I'm looking at the Baroque Cycle on my desk right now and just being like, I know I really need to read these and I want to read these, but there's a lot there. And this is a little more compact. Peter, what did you make of Polo Stan?
I really loved this book, and I think Alyssa is right to focus on that World's Fair segment in Chicago, because in so many ways it is illustrative of the book's pleasures and also kind of sort of basic approach to storytelling, which is that this book is more than anything else a kind of tour, and Stevenson acts as a tour guide for a series of places that are themselves often either explicitly or implicitly technologies. And he presents, you know, the World's Fair. A lot of what he's doing, he delivers these lists of all the things you will see, but he clearly has consulted the maps of the fair and is just walking you around the space of it and letting you see all the different booths and how they interact and all the different crazy people and then all of the different kinds of things that you might see, the X-ray machines or the different costumes and all this. And he is again sort of positing this as a kind of physical space that is also a technology, because this space acts to funnel people and move them around in a particular way and guide them towards specific types of ideas and to smash together different technologies which might produce new ideas and new different things, you know, sort of and new innovations. But even more so, there's a sequence early in the book that takes place at the, I'm going to mispronounce this, the Magnitorsk. Is that correct? It's a gigantic Russian steel mill. And there's just absolutely insane sequence that takes place as this thing is being built and excavated, and you've got all the prisoners who are moving around it. And he's just showing you how this machine works by physically moving the characters around the space. And so you get to see this vast, vast place machine. So Stevenson just loves to build these gigantic place machines. And then what he does is he tells you, you know, this machine was built to do a thing. It's a tool, right? You're going to make steel with it. You're going to show off new types of technology and get inventors to move together. But then what he wants to make this, there's always the secondary argument that comes from his place machines, because these place machines act as cultural They shape culture and they shape society as well. So much of this book is about the ways that all of this technological development shaped the way that people organize their lives, sometimes in sort of very prosaic, just physical ways, but also the ideas that were in play and the ideas that were getting that were moving through the culture, both in the United States and in Russia. And so this is a vast ideological conflict that he is portraying here. And he's portraying this conflict as being in many ways technologically determined and technologically mediated. And this is why I love Stevenson so much, is that he bridges the worlds of what we think of as hard science fiction, which is the sort of classic approach to science fiction, is like, we're just going to extrapolate technology. And a lot of my book is going to be physics calculations, or, you know, sort of explaining to you how gravity works. And you know what? If you read Seven Eves, there are a lot of physics calculations and explaining how gravity works in that book. But that book also, in Seven Eves, you also see a huge sort of, there are different theories of what do you do in a time of crisis. And there, the governments respond one way, the entrepreneurs respond another way, sort of different weird sub-factions of human beings who have organized their lives around other things respond another way. And then 5,000 years later, it all shakes out into, oh my goodness, what became of all those ideas is that for thousands of years, they percolated and changed, and you can still see the roots of them later. And this is the thing that he does so well, is he traces the historical lineage of how technology intersects with politics and with culture and with ways of living, and then the kind of factional divides that come out of all of that inevitably. And it's just such a delight to read. His prose is so exuberant, but it's also so smart about how society is developed and changed and formed and how technology makes an impact on that. I really enjoyed this. I don't know that I think it's his best novel, but it is, I think, a good entry point, in if only because it's not explicitly science fiction in a way that people will find off-putting, and it's also relatively short. The final thing I will just say is, although it's not explicitly science fiction, one great thing about what Stevenson is doing here is that he is treating the past as if it is science fiction and letting you experience this wonder and novelty of new technology that we now all take for granted, and showing us that this is what made our world.
And also risks, right? I mean, yes. An underlying theme of this book is that things that may seem merely entertaining or fanciful, or, you know, used primarily for, you know, sort of advertising, can in fact be life-alteringly dangerous. And it's also, I mean, it's a very ideologically interesting book, right? In the sense that, you know, there is sort of the grand question of the contest between the United States and the Soviet Union. But there's also an underlying theme that people who seem radically, radically different can come to the same sorts of conclusions, or that people who you find kind of repulsive or unpleasant for various ideological reasons can in fact have very sharp insights. Like, there, you know, Aurora has this sort of ongoing fascination with Bonnie and Clyde, and in particular sort of sees some parallels between Bonnie Parker's criticisms of American society and Soviet criticisms of American society. You know, she has this weird kind of brief platonic dalliance with Patton at a, you know, polo match and ball at, you know, in Washington.
Because
while she's
they didn't
doing
have Bridgerton balls back then, so.
Because, you know, I mean, lots of stuff happens on dance floors, guys, whether you like that world historical reality or not. But she has this sort of encounter with George Patton, and she's like, you know, Dawn is trying to be undercover as, like, you know, she is basically an undercover communist who is investigating what turned out to be the sort of mechanized cavalry that's going to be used to massacre the Bonus Army. But despite the fact that Patton is this kind of despicable person, and that Dawn is doing sort of a bad job of being undercover as, like, a charitable Washington lady, he sees her in a way that no one else is capable of. The way Stevenson puts it is, I have no idea what to advise to give you as a woman. I fear we have no place for you in this civilization. And I mean that as a criticism of the civilization. The man was barely sane. And though he was a bit of a nut, his theories explained certain things about Dawn and her place in the world more satisfactorily than Papa's. Too bad he was planning to massacre Dawn and her friends, right? I mean, there is this sense that totalizing ideology is just not just unsatisfactory, but insufficient, right? And that the ability to hear things from people from whom you might not want to hear them is in fact valuable and clarifying. And for Dawn, I think, like, ultimately proves to be kind of a survival skill.
Well, there's this interesting parallel in the book of Berea and Patton as two kind of older figures who understand that there is more to be done with this person, this woman than society can really allow them to, even in, you know, the supposedly more egalitarian to the sexist society of the USSR. I don't know. The ideological underpinnings of this book are fascinating, and this is the reason I am very curious to see where it goes, because Stevenson is a fascinating figure in the sense that I don't think he has any sort of delusions about either side of this struggle. I don't think he is, you know, particularly what's the word? He's not wearing rose tinted glasses when it comes to anyone, but he also understands. Look, there's a version of the story about the Bonus Army, right? That is just like, wow, look at this awful slaughter. When in fact, he kind of sets it up as like, well, there were communist cells kind of hidden all throughout it, right?
Who were like importing guns and intended to take over the U.S. government, right? I mean, right. To tie this back to our cons and non segment, like, I think part of what's really interesting about Stevenson is that he exists entirely outside, you know, both, you know, sort of conventional U.S. politics, but kind of like existing pieties about the past and the future, right? And it's what allows him to imagine things that are really fresh, right? Like, he and Kim Stanley Robinson, from whom he really in so many ways could not be more different, are two of the very few authors who I've seen who've really, you know, explored in a deep and wide-ranging way what it would mean to have, for example, corporations kind of supplant governments, right? You know, which is, again, something that's like a subject of Snow Crash and to a certain extent Ream Day. But yeah, I mean, I just think he is himself someone who exists outside both conventional politics and sort of conventional ideas of what stories like these, you know, are supposed to be like. And it's part of what makes him delightful. And I don't think you could have dreamed up Neal Stephenson in a large language model. And for that, I'm very glad.
There is a through line, an ideological through line, though, that I think to his work, which is that he is suspicious of concentrated power, basically in any form. And virtually all of his solutions, his victories, his things that he thinks are kind of obvious, that he obviously thinks are kind of wonderful and delightful, they are distributed systems that are ad hoc. And that argument comes through most strongly in Seven Eves, but throughout his work, what you see is that the things that become built, that like work best in the world, are not things that people really just, that like, certainly not that governments or sort of big, you know, powerful people who are in charge planned out. Instead, they're little people on the ground, all working, you know, sort of on their own, with maybe some goals that often overlap but are not the same. And then people just kind of work things out. And that is, I mean, that's one of the great things about his global warming book, Termination Shock, is that it sort of posits a muddling through that is, I think, in some ways scary, but and also in other ways plausible and almost reassuring.
Yeah. And yeah.
All right. Exit question. What do we think? Will we be continuing the Bomb Light cycle as it goes on? Peter.
Yes, I will be continuing, but I read everything Stevenson writes.
Yeah. Well, Alyssa.
Yeah. With considerable excitement. This is a super promising beginning. And despite the fact that Stevenson has not been successfully adapted for the movies, this would be super adaptable. And in fact, read sort of like the first season of an HBO show. It'd be super fun. I kind of want David Simon to make like David Simon's Polo Stan.
That would be fascinating. Yes. I do think I think this would be a fine TV series, but also I am excited to see. I was trying to figure out when the next book is coming out. I don't know. If anybody at the William Morrow is reading this.
There was a note, I believe, in the edition I read that said that he'd been working on this version for 10 years or something, and then like wrote some other books in the meantime besides this. Makes you wonder if maybe the next, it'll be a little while. It could be a little while, or maybe it's all already done.
I hope it's not 10 years. I don't want 10 years. I need it now. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode, Tell Your Friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, @SunnyMunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.